Hello and welcome to the first episode of the brand new Viral History Podcast, giving you your history fix in audio form. My name's Joe Forrester and I'm here with Gemma Chandler. We'll be with you every single time talking you through a different topic in history. If you want to get in touch, it's real simple. On Twitter, it's at viral underscore history. On Instagram, at viral history. The YouTube channel and the Facebook page are just simply viral history. And if you're old fashioned like us, info at viral-history.com. is the email address. Queen of France at 16 and widowed at 18, Mary Stuart defies pressure to remarry. Instead, she returns to her native Scotland to reclaim her rightful throne. However, Scotland and England fall under the rule of the compelling Elizabeth I. Each young queen beholds her sister in fear and fascination. Rivals in power and in love, and female agents in a masculine world, the two must decide how to play the game of marriage versus independence. I am, of course, talking about the brand new Mary, Queen of Scots film starring Saoirse Ronan as Mary Queen of Scots and Margot Robbie as Elizabeth I. It's out in the UK today, which is the 18th of January. And to debate this film on what I believe are two opposite sides of the argument, Dr. Estelle Perrank and Dr. Susanna Lipscombe are with us. Susanna, hello, thanks for joining us.
Hello, thank you. Yes, thank you for having me.
Estelle, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So I've had a little chat with you, Estelle, before the show started. And Mary, Queen of Scots, you're not happy with the film and with the woman herself and her place in history. Let's start with the movie and what you found problematic about that in particular.
Okay, so I'm going to be honest. And the first thing that my first problem with the movie, my first problem, as you can see, there are different problems.
So there's
my,
a list.
There's a list. My first problem, and I was bored. Okay. I was actually bored, and I thought that the timeline of the movie was off. I knew what was going on because I know the period well, but I believe that if you just the general public, it's a bit confusing how the characters are presented to you. And I was just bored, yeah, plenty bored, absolutely bored.
Susanna, yeah. Did you feel the same way? Were you bored?
No, I wasn't bored. I do think there's something about people trying to follow it. My husband didn't know the period so well, wasn't quite sure who everybody was. But I think it's a sumptuous film. I think it's beautifully made. And I found it fascinating. But then my brain was, I can't view it as like a member of the general public because I'm viewing it as a historian. Mm. And half the time I was thinking about, oh, that's interesting, they've done that or whatever. So I'm not here as film critic really, more as commentator on its historical veracity, I think.
Do you find it problematic in films where they play fast and loose with the reality of history? The best example is probably Braveheart, a film which I absolutely despise, primarily because it's got an entire generation of people both here and in America thinking that William Wallace was painted in woad and running around with his shirt off and living in a straw hut, whereas actually, as we all know, he was a member of the gentry living in a manor house. So it's slightly counterintuitive when you think of him as, I suppose, a figure of freedom and emancipation in the way that Hollywood presented him. And in this film in particular, there's a moment where Mary and Elizabeth meet, and famously, they never met. Do you find that problematic when films take license like that?
Well, I think that I would absolutely prefer historical films to be rooted in history, precisely for the same reason you've said, in that people learn from them, and that's how most people learn the history. So, for example, the series The Tudors, which is far, far further from the truth than this film is, best described, I think, by Mark Lawson as soft porn disguised as history. You know, that as far as I'm concerned, that sort of stuff is kind of intolerable. I think that there are some circumstances which are more defendable or defensible. There are several things that happen in history only by paper, but are put here in vision.
Yes.
So, for example, Elizabeth and Mary did agree to meet in York in 1562. In the film, we see Mary and her retinue en route, and then they're turned back as they meet Elizabeth's ambassador, who reports the meeting's been postponed. They did arrange to meet. Elizabeth changed her mind, but she sent a letter. Elizabeth did propose that Mary marry her favourite Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester, but it's all done by correspondence. Dudley wasn't dispatched to Scotland as he is here. And the ambassador, Thomas Randolph, didn't have to shuttle repeatedly between the two courts to convey messages, pen and paper did the trick. But letter writing is dull and it's repetitive on screen. And that's the exact reason why we have the two meeting as well, Mary and Elizabeth. And it's not like Josie Rourke is the first director or writer to be lulled into this. Schiller, Donizetti, you know, whenever you've had a play or an opera about Mary, they can't resist. They just can't resist making Mary and Elizabeth meet. And in this film, they do thing one thing that's rather clever, I think. They say, Elizabeth says to Mary, "No one can know we met. If you speak to anyone, I will deny it." So it creates this whole sort of historical possibility that they actually met and the whole thing was hushed up. So at least that's quite a clever way of getting around the problem of what you put on screen.
Yeah. And Estelle, you're ready to reply here.
Yes, because I will agree on something that Susanna just said. I think that sometimes maybe it's needed, you know, to change or to rewrite the past or to create a scene that didn't exist just to make the things more entertaining. Mm. Now my problem with I have two problems with that. The first one is that as she just said, it's not the first time in a movie that the two queens met, but now you have people coming to me, or I'm sure to even Susanna, you know, well, they tell you, even my students, for example, they say, "Oh, they never met." Like, oh God, you know, no, they didn't. So I have that problem where people actually learn also or want to learn from movies, and it's what you've said with Braveheart.
Is that a problem though? But that perhaps, I mean, I take it from the general public, but your students should be learning their history.
But I'm talking about the first years, right?
Yes.
So I'm talking about the first years, and they arrive, and they might have the questions. You just want to know the veracity.
Sure.
They're obviously there to learn. So I, you know, I don't mind the questions, but you see, I know that they learned it from movies, you know, and other movies, not just that movie. Now with the scene, Susanna is right. Elizabeth says in the movie, you know, if you tell anyone that we met, I will deny it and everything. So yes, it gives a spin on the fact that it could have happened secretly, but it couldn't. Like, Elizabeth couldn't go anywhere without people. She you know, she was the state of England. So for that, I believe that, you know, even thinking that it could have been a possibility and put it on screen is misleading for the public. Mm. And my other problem, and that's the biggest one actually, I don't mind if they meet, you know, for movies. I don't like it. I personally actually hate it, all right? But let's say I don't mind it and everything. What I really hated about that scene is the scene. The dialogue is absolutely rubbish. Mm. I mean, so you have this Mary Queen of Scots who just fled, you know, from Scotland to England. She needs desperately the help of a cousin. And she's like, "I'm your sister and we should help each other." And the next second she's like, "But I'm the right queen of England. And if you don't help me, or if you kill me, you'll kill your queen." No, she would have never said that to Elizabeth to her face. I mean, like, she needed Elizabeth's help. And the worst line, probably, of the movie is when Mary Stuart says to Elizabeth, "I'm the rightful queen of England because I am a Stuart. This is just bad history. Stuart dynasty is Scottish, and it's not why she has, you know, a right to the English throne. She has a right to the English throne because she has Tudor blood, and it's what she should have said. I am a Tudor too." And that would have been much more powerful.
Or I'm a Tudor more than you are because I'm legitimate,
yeah,
and you're not.
Yeah, in a way, yeah, she could have, you know, she could have pushed it further, you know, because, yeah, you're right. Mary Stuart actually believed that Elizabeth was, well, or there was, you know, assumptions that she, well, the Guises thought that Elizabeth was a bastard. So, yeah, you're right. So she could have said that instead of saying, you know, "I'm a Stuart," which is absolutely irrelevant and shows that they didn't really listen to the historical consultant.
Gemma, you were nodding. Yeah, do you agree?
I actually had the pleasure of going to the screening with both Susanna and Estelle.
What was that like?
I sat next to Estelle. At this point in the movie, you literally physically recoiled, I think, from
the
screen.
I'm sorry.
But I think you're right. That scene particularly, even though we all know it didn't happen, maybe they could have done a bit more with it. It was a bit cringe, to be honest. They had this weird kind of cliche where these two women are kind of walking through this barn hidden by weird veils that were hanging everywhere.
Kate
so they
Bush,
couldn't
Kate
quite
Bush
see each
clip.
Other. And then they caught a glimpse of each other. And it was just a bit bizarre, really. And also, Estelle, you just mentioned the Guise family,
yeah,
who don't really come into the movie
at all. Yeah, which is highly problematic for me.
They're the people driving the power politics, and particularly Mary, Queen of Scots, and I suppose her desire to be Queen of England as well, certainly heir to Elizabeth. They're behind the Guise family, right? Oh. So they're behind
The Guise are bad boys.
Yeah.
No, they are an extremely powerful French family, and it's simple what they wanted. They wanted to overthrow Henry III of France, and to become King of France. And they were princes of blood, so they had a right to the French throne. Mm. And they wanted Mary to become Queen of England and Scotland. And with the help of Philip II of Spain, they wanted the two new countries like England and Scotland to become French and Spanish. Well, we would be speaking French right now.
Would you prefer that?
No, not really.
May I come in on
Susanna? Yes. What would you like to say?
I think obviously no one's defending the fact that as far as the historical record is concerned, they didn't meet and they wouldn't have met in a linen workshop. And I think there are two points here. One, actually, I think Estelle's first point, I actually see it from the exact opposite point of view, which is getting people to investigate the veracity of the history is part of the point of why I like people watching historical films. Because if floating a tide lifts all boats, if it turns people towards picking up a history book, I'm all for it. Mm. And the other thing is, though, is to say that there's a sort of more profound way in which the film plays with modern or historical ideas beyond, you know, the did they, didn't they meet, or, you know, the details of what they wore or whatever, which is that one of the ideas that this film is stressing is this idea of sisterhood with a capital S between Elizabeth and Mary, which is a kind of modern sisterhood, you know, women all out to support each other. And this isn't just in that final scene, it comes repeatedly through the film as being something, you know, that really if these two could support each other. There was one point where Elizabeth says how cruel men are when she hears about Mary's forced abdication. There's a sense that, you know, they would have done much better, and wouldn't we women rule the place much better? And that's a modern idea. Mm. And it's a modern idea that's been put into the film to make it palatable to modern audiences. It's not the only one. There's also stuff about modern identity politics. Mm-hmm. There's a character in the film who is gay, and Elizabeth says to him, "You have not betrayed your nature." You know, that's not something someone would have said in the 16th century.
Yeah.
But so there's many ways in which modern ideas are present in the film that far transcend the details of did they meet, or did they write that letter, or did that thing happen.
And can I just blunder in like a bull in a china shop with my kind of, I suppose, my overview or my ill-researched opinion, as it's always been, of Mary, Queen of Scots versus Elizabeth I in terms of characterisation. So I've always thought that Elizabeth I is something of a feminist icon in terms of being an incredibly strong and forthright woman in a man's world. Obviously, she had her flaws, was quite petty and could be quite vindictive at times, but is largely an incredibly positive female role model in the context of the 16th century. Whereas I've always thought of Mary I as being quite the opposite, quite insipid and led by men. Am I right to say that?
Do you want to go first, Susanna?
shall I leave the room? Because I think...
No, it's because it's not actually about... The thing is, to be honest, Joe, your idea here is not necessarily about the truth any more than what the film represents is.
Mm.
There's a kind of characterisation of Mary throughout the years as being given too much to passion and, that Elizabeth is this person who is, as you say, kind of proto-feminist icon who is strong and makes these choices. And quite a lot of the time in films, that is particularly played on. And what we have here is a kind of turning that normal filmic narrative, I'm not even talking about the history, but the filmic narrative on its head. So here we have instead a Mary who is apparently decisive and is passionate, but, you know, knows what she wants, whereas Elizabeth is portrayed as kind of weak and frigid. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting. If you've seen the Shekhar Kapoor film from 1998,
yes,
where Kate Blanchett played Elizabeth,
yes,
at the very beginning of that film, there's a contrast drawn up in a very similar way between,
yeah,
Mary the First,
okay, yeah,
who's portrayed as unnatural and,
yeah,
you know, can't have children, and her court is, you know, in the
gloom,
yeah, and the,
yeah,
dark, and,
yeah,
and whereas Elizabeth suddenly comes on screen and it's bright white and it's outside and she has her hair down and she's dancing with a man and she's all sort of natural and she's not frigid, Mary is, and here it's turned on their head. So it's just, I'm afraid, what we're boiling down to is good old-fashioned stereotypes about women. And, you know, you can't have two women who are both decisive, passionate, and level-headed, because apparently women can't be all those things at once. So you have to characterise them as one or the other.
Now, I would agree with what she said. I would just add one thing, just because I think Mary Stuart in many ways was, I'm talking about the historical character here, and it's in my opinion from the sources I've read, she was quite manipulated, or not, you know, by men, mostly by her uncles. I think she was very much in control of her first husband, Francis II of France. Mm. Francis II of France was absolutely in love with her. We have records of that where people were, you know, noting that he was smitten with her, and he was, oh, Mary Stuart, ooh. You know, you can imagine scenes in the garden and stuff. And why don't we have those scenes? Anyway, but what I'm saying, like, but I think that then, you know, we have someone, Elizabeth I is a feminist icon. She was not, obviously, feminism didn't exist at that time. She was not in support of women.
Mm.
She was in support of herself, right? That's also something we have to know about Elizabeth. Elizabeth says, I'm an extraordinary woman. So I'm not like any other woman. I'm extraordinary. So
the implication being that by being extraordinary, yeah,
exactly. So, but I agree with the, you know, with the analysis of Susanna about the rest of how women are portrayed. You know,
is that perhaps even just an accident of birth? Because the culture of the Scottish nobles, they seem to be a bit more kidnappy. they're a bit more kidnappy and a bit more stabby, aren't,
yeah,
they? It's and you can't imagine that happening in Elizabeth's court, or is that a product of the women themselves, do you think, Estelle?
First of all, I guess there's some truth in it, because Marie de Guise, so Mary Stuart's mother, decided to send her daughter in France. There's obviously this, like, this idea that Scottish court was a bit rough. And it's always been seen like that, at least, you know, from continental Europe, or even from England, to be fair. It was very different from other European courts.
Mm.
So, yes, I think that there's a bit of truth of that. But let's not forget that Elizabeth I was declared bastard at 3 years old, and then she was not at court. So she had a really rough childhood. And so, yes, I think, you know... What do you think, Gemma?
I agree. Something I wanted to ask you both about, actually, was kind of coming back to that artistic license. Was the filmmaker's decision to visibly age Elizabeth a lot in the film,
mm-hmm,
whereas Mary looks as fresh-faced at the end, mm, when, mm-hmm, she comes to her death, as she did right at the start when she's,
mm-hmm,
18, I think, when she lands back,
yeah,
in,
after 20 years of house arrest
in Scotland.
Yeah, she looks,
yeah,
beautiful.
Yeah,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
and I wondered what you guys thought of that, because it seemed like a deliberate
I'm going to let Susanna answer that, because she actually wrote a piece on that, and I really agree. So,
Well, I think I found that confusing, and I think in filmic terms, I found that confusing. I've seen the film twice now, and it's only the second time around that I thought I realised what the point of it was. In practice, actually, we know that the 18 years that she was imprisoned in England completely destroyed Mary,
yeah,
physically and mentally. She had lots of physical problems and would not have looked as she did in 1561.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, you can tell it's totally conscious. Not only do we have all these shots of Elizabeth ageing, but suddenly we've had Guy Pearce playing Cecil,
mm-hmm,
Lord Burley, and then suddenly he's replaced by Simon Russell Beale. You can tell that because they're wearing the same pendant, so you can tell,
mm-hmm,
they're supposed to be the same person.
Yeah.
So there is definitely a conscious choice made here not to age Mary, and the thing I think it's about is because, and I'd love to know what Josie Rourke was thinking, but is because we have at the same time a sort of voiceover line from Elizabeth saying that in her mind's eye she sees Mary not as an aged woman but as a young resplendent queen. And I think that actually suddenly that moment, that the execution at the end, is in many ways we are to imagine her as Elizabeth does. And maybe that's the thing as a whole. Maybe that's the key to the film as a whole, is that actually Elizabeth is fearful of the fact that Mary is desirable to men, produces a son, you know, has a sort of power that Elizabeth fears not having. You know, in this film, there's one moment where she holds up her skirts as if she's pregnant and then sort of drops them quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her rival is doing all these things that Elizabeth is not doing. So I'm wondering if actually maybe the film as a whole is a kind of this fearful fantasy of what her rival was like.
That's a good point, but I would say, and I didn't notice, you know, the things with the dress and when she pretended to be pregnant, but at the same time, we do know from Elizabeth's writing that she didn't want, you know, to go down that route from a very, early age even, you know. So I think that I'm not sure that she really... I think in a way, I would agree with that, but it would definitely explain why we have, you know, a really old queen and a very young one. That would make a really good explanation, actually.
I mean, you're absolutely right, so that historically speaking, that's not the case. It's not what Elizabeth wants. so I was just wondering about it as a kind of filmic trope. Yeah.
What do you mean, historically speaking, it's not what Elizabeth wants?
She doesn't want to become pregnant. We know from an early age that she says that she wants to stay single. So I completely agree with you. I was thinking of it more as a filmic trope.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. So in the film, we have a different kind of Elizabeth. And you also said, Susanna, something very interesting. We have the portrayal of Elizabeth that's really weak as well, you know, throughout the movie. And even when we have, some scenes when she's at court, she's just, playing or talking with Robert Dudley. She's not doing much. When she was very much, in charge of her government, and I would really argue that she was not just, you know, playing around and being, you know, an old woman waiting for her death.
Although interestingly, one thing that is imported from later in her reign is we've got this scene where they're standing on top of Hardwick Hall, actually, which is become Elizabeth's palace, where she says, "I, you know, want to be a man," or words to that effect, and I have become a man or something, and that we have all of this sort of adoption of the Elizabeth image of the 1590s, say, the bewigged, fully fledged, white faced virgin queen, and that whole narrative is imported into the 1560s, you know.
And it's quite problematic because we know that it was based on John Guy's book, and John Guy is obviously an expert on the later, you know, years of Elizabeth's reign, and trying to push and to crush everything together, this 44 years of a massive reign together into, you know, like the first 20 years of Elizabeth's reign, or 30 years, for me it's really problematic.
It's not done in his book. I mean, his book on Mary.
No, but
I'm
talking about the other book that he just because he obviously publishes. He published two books on Elizabeth letters years, you know, of her reign.
Yes,
so
years or whatever.
So I think in a way we know that he was in, you know, he was probably the historical consultant, and probably that's why, you know, as you said, the letter years were like put in. You know.
Or it's just because it's the image we all know. I mean, I think it's because it's such a powerful image that it's hard to resist Elizabeth turning up with her white face and her red hair and her, you know, vermilion cheeks. I think it's hard to tell a story about Elizabeth on film that doesn't import that. Because it's so persuasive, and it is sort of true by the time of her death, 1587, you could argue, but it's just that it arrives in the film much earlier historically.
Is it potentially an issue of we're saying, okay, so some people who aren't going to particularly research the topic further, you think we've got one crack at the whip of showing them Elizabeth, let's show them everything they're expecting? Do you think it's the filmmakers being making life easy for themselves, I suppose?
I actually thought it was a little bit unexpected, her portrayal. Okay. Yeah, she kind of... I think if you're a fan of Elizabeth I, she doesn't come across at all how you want her to. would you agree?
That's for sure. Susanna, what do you think about, you know?
I mean, I think Joe's theory is a very plausible one. It's really interesting. It's clearly a decision that's made. This is not an accident that we see her like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not intelligent enough to be able to tell you exactly why that is the case. But I think it's intriguing. I think it's an intriguing one.
Let's get some final thoughts. Susanna, we'll start with you. I sense that you liked the film more than Estelle did. How would you sum up the film in a sentence?
That's damning, isn't it? Like it more than Estelle did. Yes, I liked it more than Estelle did.
That could go on the poster. I liked it more than Estelle did.
I would say that actually there's a lot of history you can trust. A lot of the stuff that people are going to think is too far-fetched to be possibly historical actually is the case. From minor things like the fact that Mary Queen of Scots actually did ride astride as opposed to side saddle, really unusual detail that they've got right, or the fact that we see Elizabeth with smallpox. I don't think we see that in many other films. Or even the fact that there are people of different nationalities and ethnic backgrounds in the cast actually isn't as historically inaccurate as people think. But above all, those key moments of like the very bloody murder, the bisexuality, a lot of this stuff is true. So, you know, I would say, although that you know about the big thing that you know is not historically true, the meeting, there's a lot of stuff here you can trust.
Marks out of 10.
On what grounds? As a film or as a piece of history?
As a film, as you enjoyed it, I suppose.
I would say a solid 7.5 or 8.
Okay, Estelle's jaw just hit the floor.
You're so generous. I would disagree a bit. I mean, yes, you know, the murder was true. Everything that Susanna said, I actually agree with, apart from the bisexuality of Darnley. Though we do have, and she's right when she says it, that we have evidence of rumours, contemporary rumours. We don't have strong evidence. And the only reason why I'm pointing that out is because I'm very careful with this, mostly because of the reputation of other kings who were, you know, said to be homosexual and they were not. So like Henry III of France, for example, where we have absolutely no evidence whatsoever of his homosexuality, and he's been portrayed for centuries as homosexual. There's nothing wrong with that, you know, being homosexual and everything, but it's just if it's not true and it's not the case, it's a bit problematic.
With Darnley, though, he was found in bed.
But the source cannot be, like, I mean, the source was from one of his detractors. So can we really, I mean, I, the way I'm going to put it for both of us to agree, hopefully to agree, but if we disagree, it's fine. But I would say that in history, we have different sources. And all sources are problematic when you're a historian and when you look at them, because they tell you a version of one story. My only concern is that I try to look at, you know, and it's not just me, like, you have other, like, experts that have worked in that field, like, and I'm going to name Michael Kessier and Carol Levin, who's worked on the relationship and the Catholicism, Protestantism of early modern England, and they found lots of sources, and I have as well found lots of sources that said that Darnley was actually a womanizer. So when Susanna said that, she's absolutely right. We have also contemporary evidence that he might have been bisexual, but I just don't buy it myself. Mm-hmm. But now that the director wants to go down that route to fit her narrative of the story, it's fine. You know, it's not like she's wrong. But to say that it's true, we don't really know. Let's put it that way. We can't be sure 100%.
Okay, so out of 10?
Oh, no, she put 7.5.
You can't go into minus.
No, but I won't go to minus. I'm not that bitchy. I'm just wrenched. Honestly, I won't see it again. So to be that bad for me not to want to watch something again on Elizabeth I, when I watch The Tudors, which was great. The Tudors was 5 and that was 3.
Wow.
I just don't want to watch it again.
Estelle, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Susanna, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
It's time for what's going to become a regular weekly feature. Now, Gemma, let me tell you, I love an idiom.
I have heard that you like an idiom, Joe.
I love an idiom.
I can't wait to hear
It's worth saying as well, Dr. Estelle Perenc is still with us. She's thrilled to be here because she's just kicking back and on her phone now. She's done the bit she was interested in.
Be nice.
I love an idiom. And for those of you who don't know what an idiom is, it's a funny little piece of language that crops up, and often the root is somewhat obscure. Well, that's where I come in. Have you heard the expression, the cat's out the bag?
No, I'm French. What the fuck?
Maybe for...
have you heard that?
Maybe for Estelle's benefit, then we should say what it means.
Yeah, I think
the
it would be nice.
Out the bag. It's like the secret's out. It's like everyone knows how much you hate Mary Queen of Scots. The cat is out the bag.
Okay. Mm, what were you thinking?
No, I'm not going to say.
Wow.
No, but you never know.
Clean, Estelle.
See, you're thinking too.
Dr. Estelle, this is an intellectual podcast, I'll have you know.
We said it was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, as Gemma said, it means to mistakenly reveal a secret. Gemma, have you ever thought about where it might come from?
I've never thought about where it might come from. No,
France.
I take it you're going to enlighten us.
Your life would be very empty if you'd spent time thinking about where that phrase had come from. Okay, so the origin... Up to and including the 18th century, a common street fraud included replacing valuable pigs with less valuable cats and selling them in bags. So people would be selling animals on the street, and they might be selling piglets, for example. Go, oh, I've got a bag. See this wriggling bag? It's all full of piglets. But if you replace them with cats, the cats aren't worth as much money, but people would still think that it's a piglet. But if a cat was to poke its little whiskery face out of the bag, then the fraud would be discovered. Therefore, the cat is out of the bag. Estelle, you're looking at me like you don't believe me.
Not at all. You bullshit that, right? You have no idea and you just came up with that.
I've done my research. I found it on a little place called the internet.
Wikipedia.
How many cats were just like roaming around, you know, able to be stuffed into a sack?
Yeah, and also I don't...
That's your question, Gemma. Seriously?
That's what's worrying me. Yeah.
Well, I don't buy pigs by the bag. I buy pigs by the pig. You do, don't you? If I was in the market for a pig, I wouldn't want a sack of pigs.
So see, maybe your story...
Well, you wouldn't want a sack of kittens either.
No, you wouldn't. When you get, but surely you hear them
meet at a young age.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? What's but a young pig as well? Equally, I mean, that's troublesome. If anybody knows whether that's true or not, please do get in touch. At viral_history.
No, don't.
Let the abuse. Can people please tweet us and let Estelle know that she's wrong, and I am absolutely right in this rock solid, well researched historical fact that I've just thrown out there without a second thought.
You can't take it back now. It's out there.
I can't. I've said it. I've said it now. It's done. Right. Every week we're going to run a competition. And we're running the competition for purely cynical and selfish reasons.
Definitely.
Because we want people... That's why I do anything, Gemma. We want people to get involved and to review the show. We want to know what you're thinking. 5-star reviews will, of course, be looked upon favourably. That goes without saying. But we do want you guys to tell us what you think. Obviously, it's a new project. We want to know if you're enjoying it, what we could do better, what you want to hear more of, how great my cat's out the bag idiom is, anything that you're thinking, we want to hear. So do write a review on whatever podcast app you choose to listen to us on. But every week, we're going to pick our favourite. And we want it to be done from the perspective of a historical figure, don't we, Gemma?
We do.
I've got a nice example here. Okay, so we want it to be done from the point of view of a historical figure. I'll give you an example, Estelle. So, this is a 5-star review that we might get. 5 stars. Just a reminder. 5 stars. Hi, guys. I came across your podcast while on a very stressful work trip. I've been everywhere from the Mongolian steppe to China to Russia. And let me tell you, after leaving my genetic imprint on 1 in 200 of the world's population, I'm bloody knackered. This pod is a great way to unwind at the end of a long day of mindless slaughter. Highly recommended, Mr. G. Khan.
I don't want that review.
But that's from Estelle.
Could you just say 5-star? It was awesome.
But that's if Genghis Khan had taken time out of his busy schedule of pillaging his way across
Yeah, but I don't like it.
You don't like it?
No.
Other examples are available. Okay, Estelle, I feel like I'm going to have to work very hard to impress you and win you over. Yeah.
I'll draw you.
I'd quite like to hear from the cats that were stuffed in the bag.
Oh, bloody hell. Why do you keep on...
Gemma is... Estelle's disappointed in you now as well.
I know.
And she's a bit scared of me. She's a bit...
You're on the other side of the desk. I'm right next to her.
What does that mean? Yeah, that's true. I have a bad reputation.
I'm not, do you know what? I'm not scared of you, Estelle, but I do think you're an unpredictable maverick.
Yeah, you're right.
Which is a compliment, I would say. But
I hope so, because otherwise you're going to get slapped.
Do leave us a review on your podcast app of choice. From the perspective of a historical person, so it could be from the perspective of Mary, Queen of Scots. It could be from the perspective...
Elizabeth I.
Of Elizabeth
the
First.
The best ever.
We will pick our favourite, and the winner will be announced on the next podcast in 2 weeks' time. And the winner will receive quite the prize. They will get a copy of Kate Williams' new book, The Betrayal of Mary, Queen of Scots. So get typing away, leave your review from the perspective of a historical figure, and we will pick our favourite. The winner will get Kate's new book. Right, that's it from the first episode of the Viral History Podcast. Gemma, have you enjoyed yourself?
I've had a wonderful time. It's been nice to be reunited with Estelle again and hear how much she hates that film.
Yeah.
You did it. Come on. You knew that I hated it. I told you.
I definitely know. I know.
Sorry.
And now everybody else knows. I know. I can feel it. Estelle, have you enjoyed yourself?
Yeah, very much so. It was very, very nice.
Excellent. Very nice. That's what we're going for.
I think we definitely need to have you back.
Lots of fun, really. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think she wants to come back.
We could make a mini series, things that Estelle hates.
Everything that goes with Mary, Queen of Scots.
Exactly.
Ta-da!
It's a long running series.
And now idioms, we can add that one to as well.
I'm going to win you over with one of my idioms one day, Estelle. One day I'll win you over.
So?
We'll Dr. Estelle Perrank, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Gemma, thank you. It's been a blast. If you want to get in touch with us, it's super easy to do so. Twitter at @viral_history. Instagram is at @viral_history. Facebook and YouTube, simply search Viral History. And if you want to drop us an email, info@viral-history.com. We'll see you next time.